The world deals with facts. God is not the world. He's the mystical realm. Then finally, processism. Process theology. Reality is constantly changing. Proponent Alfred North, that should be, not no, Alfred North Whitehead. He was the son of an Anglican minister. He wrote Religion in the Making, 1926, Process and Reality, 1929. He said, God is continually in the process of change. Language expresses changing experience. Result, God is limited in changing. He can't know the future for sure. One process theologian said, God is sitting up in heaven, looking over the banister of heaven, down through the corridor of time, holding his breath, waiting to see how things are going to turn out. He's looking, so now what's going to happen? Oh my goodness, I didn't see that. Ooh, look what they're doing over there. And so he is reacting to what man does, trying his best to keep this whole thing going in the right direction, because he's finite and limited. Like Rabbi Kushner had a process view of God. God is finite, imperfect. Don't blame him. Just forgive God and go on and live your life. He can't do any better than that. I debated Rabbi Kushner for 3 hours on the John Ankerberg show. There are video tapes of it available. I think it's in that little... Oh, I didn't give it to you. I was going to... After, I'll give you these. It has tapes and videos in them. John, it was fun debating Rabbi Kushner because, you know, he was a process theologian. God is finite and limited. God is just kind of, doting along, trying to see what he can do to keep this thing from going in the wrong direction, but his hands are tied. Not a biblical God at all, and he claimed it was a biblical God. Can't know the future. Exodus 3:14. I am that I am. Process theologian said no, and here's how philosophy influences exegesis. That really means I will become what I will become. Well, try John 8:58, when Jesus said, before Abraham was, I will become what I will become. And Jesus was wrong in his understanding, because he said, before Abraham was, I am. Not I was, or I will become what I will become, but I am. That's the self-existent Yahweh. Truth is relative and changing. Need we say any more about that in a relative and changing society? Someone said the problem today is the relativity of Einstein is considered absolute, and the absolutes of the Bible are considered relative. That's a strange day, to be sure. Now, some additional presuppositions to be aware of. General presuppositions, the newer, the truer. Reason is right. Who said so? If I had a bet, I'd say old is gold, not the newer, the truer, because it's time-tested. Truth is on the side of scholarship. I know a lot of ignorant scholarship, because there is no correlation between truth and scholarship. You can be very sloppy scholar on the truth, and a lot of evangelicals are, or you can be a very accurate scholar on error. A lot of liberals are. There's no correlation between truth and scholarship. There ought to be. We ought to have both. We ought to be good scholars and have the truth too. But it doesn't always come that way. Truth is not always on the side of scholarship. Meaning what is found in significance, how it applies. I wish I had time to say more about that one. Meaning what is determined by purpose. Why? One illustration to show you that that's not true. I'm going to give you a sentence and ask you if you understand the meaning. After class tonight, I want to take you all out to have a Coke. To have a Coca-Cola. Does anyone doesn't understand what that means? After class tonight, I want to take you all out and buy you a Coca-Cola. Perfectly understandable. You understand every word. Now, do you know the purpose of that? You know why I want to do that? No. You know, the foggiest idea. It might be just because I'm a nice guy. Might be because I want to buy your favor. Might be because I want some more time because I want to give you all $1 million. I might be because I want to borrow 100,000 reasons. You don't know what my purpose is. All you know is the meaning of the statement. Come, let's have a Coca-Cola after class tonight. So you can know meaning without purpose. Therefore, purpose couldn't possibly determine meaning. If purpose determined meaning, the Israelites, certainly I, wouldn't know what it means when the Old Testament says, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. I still don't know what that means, if purpose determines meaning. But I do know exactly what it means. It means don't take a baby goat and put it in its mother's milk and turn up the heat to 212 Fahrenheit at sea level to boil. I know exactly what it means. I just don't know the purpose. What was the purpose for that? I am sure that Bill Gothard's not right, that milk is hard to digest, meat is hard to digest, and meat boiled in milk will give you indigestion, and God doesn't want you to have indigestion. I'm sure that's not the purpose, but I don't know what the purpose really was either, so I shouldn't criticize him too severely. Extra-biblical data can determine the meaning of a text. Be careful. If extra-biblical data determines the meaning of the text, then the text in and of itself is not authoritative. Mm-hmm. What's authoritative is what comes from outside the Bible. The homosexuals do that with Genesis 19, 18 and 19. They say, oh, well, there was a custom there that you were responsible for the lives of the people who came to your home, and so the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was inhospitality, not sodomy, not homosexuality. Careful using extra-biblical data to determine the meaning of a text. Or, historical grammatical method is inadequate. I hear people today, they want to add to the historical grammatical method. You don't need to add anything to it. It's perfectly adequate. You don't need to add all these other things like F genre decisions must be made up front. What in the world does that mean? You got to determine the type of literature it is before you can study it and get the truth out of it. You got this category of 12 kinds of literature, and you got to pick which one it is and then superimpose it on the text and say, ah, this is myth. So then you read it not as truth, you read it as though it's myth. No wonder they come baloney in, baloney out. 3, how to avoid liberalism while doing evangelical exegesis. First of all, some spiritual advice for the soul, and then some intellectual advice for the mind. 1, avoid the desire to become a famous scholar. If that's your purpose, to become a famous scholar, then your motivation is pride. And what are the 3 great sins? 1 John 2, all that's in the world? Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride of life. Just think about it. Just about everything appeals to our eyes, appeals to our flesh, or appeals to our pride. And I know a lot of young scholars, and their whole thrust is, I want to make a name for myself in the world of scholarship, so I'm going to come up with this new view. You may make a name for yourself, but I can guarantee you the new view is not going to be an orthodox view. Louis Berry Chafer was once criticized by some theologians, said he hasn't had a new idea in, I forget what it was, 20 or 30 years. What a compliment. What a compliment. You know, it's like Billy Graham was criticized for setting Christianity back 200 years, and he apologized, said, I'm very sorry. I was trying to set it back 2,000 years. Avoid the desire to become a famous scholar. 2, always choose lordship over scholarship. Suppose Jesus said there was a worldwide flood in the days of Noah, and modern scholars say there wasn't. Choose lordship over scholarship. Suppose Jesus said Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish. Modern scholars say you can't live in a whale. He couldn't breathe. He couldn't have any food to eat. Choose lordship over scholarship. Suppose Jesus said there was one Isaiah. Suppose I could show you, and I can, that Jesus said there was one and only one Isaiah, not 2 Isaiahs, Proto and Deutero Isaiah. And suppose all modern scholars, most of them do, think there are at least 2 Isaiahs. What do you choose? Lordship over scholarship. Scholars are wrong, the Lord is right. Because if he's the Son of God, and he said there was a Noah and a flood, and Adam and an Eve, and they were literally created, and he did, and if he said there was one Isaiah, and he did, if he said Daniel was a prophet, not a historian, and he did, and the liberal scholars say just the opposite, who's right? No choice for a real Bible-believing Christian, is there? It's lordship over scholarship. The late Dr. Barton Payne, who was a great conservative Old Testament scholar, was once talking to a liberal friend of his, and the liberal said, he believed in all these things, you know, no literal Jonah, no literal flood, Adam and Eve, the whole bit. And Barton Payne said, well, Jesus believed all that, and he went through all the verses, you know. Matthew 19, Adam and Eve, you know, Matthew 24, Noah and the flood, Matthew 12, Jonah, and the whale, went through all those things. And the little boy looked at him and he said, I know more about the Bible than Jesus did. About batting an eyelash. Well, if you know more about the Bible than Jesus, you're in a position to believe in a late Daniel and two Isaiahs and no miracles and the gospel and all of these other ridiculous things. Always choose lordship over scholarship. 3, resist the temptation to be unique. Often unique equals wrong. Do not dance on the edges. There's a lot of evangelical scholars like to push the edges. How far can I go and still be an evangelical? You know, dancing on the edges. What's the story that's told about the king who was looking for a chauffeur and he lived way up in the mountains and there was a narrow road and at times the car was just that close to the edge of a big cliff and he interviewed these chauffeurs and he said to them, now, how close can you drive to the edge of that and still be safe? I've been driving for years, he said. I can get within about 8 inches of the edge. That'd be no problem at all. The next guy King interviewed, he said, how close can you get to the edge and still be safe? He said, I can get within 4 inches of the edge of that and still be perfectly safe because I know exactly this road and how to drive. And the third guy came in, he said, how close can you get? He said, I would stay as far as I could to the other side of the road, away from that edge. Guess who the king hired? He didn't hire the guy who was dancing on the edges, or he didn't hire the guy who was driving on the edges. He got the guy who stayed as far away from that cliff as possible. Higher criticism is a cliff. And there are way too many evangelicals who are driving by the edge, trying to see how far, how close they can get to disaster. Do not flirt with the latest critical fads. Do not allow morality to determine methodology. Do not trade orthodoxy for academic respectability. I'll never forget W.A. Criswell, who regretted what had happened to the Southern Baptists and how they drifted away. And he narrated what had happened because he had been around all of that time that they had drifted. In fact, he was president of the Southern Baptists way back when, while they were drifting. And he regretted the whole thing. And he said, you know what happened? We got all these colleges and we got all these seminaries and we needed accreditation. We needed academic respectability. So how do you get that? Well, you get scholars with PhDs from respectable universities, you know, Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Oxford and all over the world. So he sent... We sent our best young men and we got the best degrees and we got academic respectability. We just traded orthodoxy for it. And the world will always do that. They'll give you a little bit of their academic respectability if you give them a little bit of your orthodoxy, and they'll give you a lot of their academic respectability if you give them a lot of your orthodoxy. It's not a good trade. You're trading truth. You're trading truth for fame and reputation. Above all, bring every thought captive to Christ. To me, as an evangelical scholar, the most challenging verse in the New Testament is 2 Corinthians 10:5. We destroy arguments and every proud obstacle against the knowledge of God and bring every thought captive to Christ. That's hard to bring every thought because the mind wants to wander because the mind is proud, because love builds up but knowledge puffs up. I mean, it's an academic hazard. It's an inbuilt hazard of being a scholar that you are constantly tempted with pride. It's just part of the profession because you want to make a mark for yourself. You want to do something new. You want to say something unique. You want people to read your books. You want to be recognized in the field. You want to leave something for mankind. It's just pride, pride, pride at every turn of the road. You got to constantly bring every thought captive to Christ. Some intellectual advice for the mind. Get both your theology and your methodology from the Bible. Not just the theology. Reject any methodology inconsistent with the Bible. Inspired New Testament use of the Old Testament is hermeneutically definitive. If the New Testament says that's what it means, then the New Testament is inspired and right. I remember the day I was sitting in Dr. Walvoord's office at Dallas Seminary, and we were talking about higher criticism and its influence on some of the faculty members at Dallas Seminary. And he was a little bit disbelieving, and right beyond his head on the shelf behind was a book called Walvoord. It was a festra put together by scholars in honor of him. And I said, right there in that book behind you is a faculty member of your institution that says that there is a mistake in Hebrews chapter 2, but don't worry about it because that's not what the author of Hebrews was stressing. He was just stressing something else there. And, you know, his eyes bugged out like he hadn't read the chapter and seen the point. It's very easy to do. And I think that we have to be very careful as evangelicals. If the New Testament uses a passage, if the New Testament quotes an Old Testament passage, and I'm referring here to the phrase, little lower than the angels in Hebrews 2, a quotation from Psalm 9, and I'm fully aware that the Hebrew says a little lower than Elohim, but I'm also aware of the fact the word Elohim can mean angels, judges, or God. And if the New Testament says that should be translated angels, then by George, that should be translated angels, because the New Testament can't be giving an inspired wrong interpretation of the Old Testament. If the New Testament says that's what it means, that's what it means. Take a look at it again. Whatever current scholarship may be saying, it must mean a little lower than the angels, not a little lower of the God who created the universe. And by the way, there are plenty of hermeneutical cues right in the context in Psalm 2 to indicate that that should be translated angels, because God is always referred to in the passage in the second person, not in the third person. And we aren't a little lower than God. We're a lot lower than God. We're just a little lower than the angels. So you don't have to do hermeneutical violence to the text to understand it the way the New Testament does. The New Testament is inspired, and the New Testament quotes it as meaning something. That's what it means. All right, let me stop there and see if you have any questions, comments about the first, anything we've said so far, and we'll take a little break here. Any questions, comments?
E. Earl Ellis in Paul's Use of the Old Testament said that Paul was kind of grammatico-historical plus, and kind of linked him with kind of the Alexandrian idea. I was wondering if that was is the inspired usage of the Old Testament in the New, and it's not necessarily always grammatico-historical. Does that still mean that we need to stick exclusively to grammatico-historical?
I think Ellis is wrong, and I think it's not historical grammatical plus anything. It's first historical grammatical period. Again, I refer you to New Testament Use of the Old Testament by S. Lewis Johnson, an excellent book that avoids that problem. Remember, Ellis is an A-mill. He has an A-mill axe to grind. And A-mills spiritualize away prophecy. So it's got to be historical grammatical plus, otherwise you wouldn't be able to be an A-mill. I mean, if you take those literally in context, they refer to a literal national fulfillment in Israel. And if you take them any other way, to take them any other way, you got to put a plus in there somewhere or a minus, because you either got to negate the historical grammatical, or you got to supplement it with something else to say, well, but there's a higher, deeper spiritual meaning for the church in order to do away with the literal implications of the millennialism that's got to be there, because there has never been a time in human history where Abraham's literal descendants have possessed unto perpetuity the land from the Euphrates to the Nile, covering the whole land of Israel. And the Bible promises that unconditionally to the literal sons of Abraham. That has never been fulfilled. And Romans 11 was written after, about the future of Israel. And even when Paul got to Romans 11, it says there's still a literal future for Israel. And just see how those A-mills, some of them only interpret Romans up to chapter 8. They don't even tackle Romans chapter 11, because if they did, they wouldn't be an A-mill.
Thank you.
Any other thoughts, comments, questions? Well, let's take a break. Well, maybe have some after the break. We need a stretch break here. In here, if you have some questions that you thought of in the break, we'll take those before we dive into Spinoza here. One over here.
Yes, were there any particular thinkers that Wittgenstein based his work off of? It kind of sounds a little bit Kantian.
Yes, his work comes out of the Immanuel Kant, and of course it's a, in addition to Immanuel Kant, he's one of those persons who is a fountainhead of his own. He stands on the shoulders of the past, but he also creates something new for the future. So he was heavily influenced by Kierkegaard, Tolstoy, Immanuel Kant. So he is a combination of existentialism and agnosticism, and ended up an cognostic and a fideist. All right, let's take a look at Benedict Spinoza. Now, I want to go back and take a few of these people we alluded to earlier, because they were so seminal, so important to understanding biblical criticism in the higher and negative sense. And Benedict Spinoza is one of those. Life and Works of Spinoza, 1632-1677. He was born to Portuguese Jewish refugees in Amsterdam. He was a lens grinder by trade. He never taught philosophy. He was excommunicated from the synagogue in 1656 for believing that God is extended. That's another way of saying pantheism. After all, Jews are monotheists. And he believed that God was extended in space and time, the universe. God is coterminous with the universe. Angels are imaginary, and denying biblical teaching on the immortality of the soul. Actually, they didn't excommunicate him for the main reasons that we're concerned about, which has to do with anti-supernaturalism. His main works are Tractatus, Theologica Politicus, and Ethics, 1674. He died of TB in 1677. He was influenced by several important thinkers. Plotinus, and that name's come up now twice tonight. You cannot do better than to understand Plotinus if you want to understand medieval philosophy, absolutely essential. And I think if you want to understand modern philosophy, you need to understand Plotinus. Now, in his case, fortunately, he only wrote one book. Usually great men wrote a bunch of books, you know, like C.S. Lewis and even Immanuel Kant and these people, and they never stop writing Aristotle. You can hardly ever read everything Aristotle said, or try reading St. Augustine or Thomas Aquinas, my favorite author. He wrote almost 100 books in his lifetime, but some of them were multi-volume sets, like one set is 60 volumes in the Latin-English translation. So he wrote the equivalent of 200 books in 19 years. He started writing when he was 30, and he died when he was 49, before his 50th birthday. And in 19 years, with no typewriter and no computer, he wrote over 200, might be 300 books, the equivalent we have. He'd keep four secretaries going at once. Start one book with this secretary, and then quote to this one, and go back to that one. I mean, we don't have minds like that. We don't have people with that ability. And just one of his books, the Summa Theologica, which is the greatest systematic theology ever written by far in a way, as I said, is over 60 volumes long. Well, the nice thing about Plotinus is the guy only wrote one book. It's called the Enneads. That's the good news. If you want to be a Thomas scholar, you got to read a lot of books. If you want to be a Plotinus scholar, you just read one. The bad news is, it's almost impossible to understand the book because it's very mystical and philosophical and Platonic and pantheistic, and it's very difficult to understand. Plotinus himself was a man after my own heart, though. He wrote the book, and he was terrible on spelling. He didn't know how to spell. He didn't know how to punctuate. So he gave it to Porphyry, his secretary, and he said, "Hey, you Porph, put this thing together. Put some periods and exclamation points in this thing." And so he did all the proofreading on it, and he brought it back to Plotinus, and he said, "Here, take a look at it." He said, "Nah, I don't want to see it, just let it go, you know. That's exactly the way I feel. Just pour it out there, you know, and get it out, and then let somebody else figure out where the punctuation goes and the spelling." Well, Benedict Spinoza was heavily influenced by Plotinus, also by a Jewish philosopher named Moses Maimonides, a very important medieval thinker. In fact, he was referred to with the greatest respect by the scholastics. They would call him Rabbi Moses, and Thomas Aquinas and the 13th century people. But he's the fountainhead of a lot of rationalism and allegorism in the Old Testament. Then there was Euclid, geometric rationalism. Spinoza was deeply influenced by Euclid because Euclid had a system worked out where you just take the axioms and you can just deduce all the mathematical truths from them. And so Spinoza said, wouldn't it be nice if we could do that in philosophy? Just take philosophical, self-evident axioms and deduce everything else from it. And that's what he did. He set up a deductive form of rationalism. He was also heavily influenced by Descartes, a contemporary. Descartes was the one that said, I think, therefore I am. Actually, that's wrong. You have to exist before you can think. So it's I am, therefore I think. But, you know, you got Descartes before De Horse. then there was a guy named Philo. He was a Jewish philosopher just before the time of Christ. God is the ground of all being. The Bible is not to be interpreted literally. And we'll meet that friend more than once. That Alexandrian allegorical school of interpretation actually started way back with the Pythagoreans and then into Plato and then into people like Philo and the Neoplatonists and Plotinus. And guess who the schoolmate of Plotinus was? Origen. The Greek father Origen and Plotinus both studied under Ammonius Saccas and Neoplatonists, and they got all this mysticism and Gnostic type teaching, pantheism and allegorical teaching from Ammonius Saccas. And Origen is, in my opinion, the origin of all heresy. You could spell his name O-R-I-G-I-N and it'd be just about correct, because he ended up a universalist, denying the literal bodily resurrection, denying the inspiration of the Bible, and saying a man pre-existed. I mean, almost all heresies started with Origen. He got it from his Plotinian roots. That's the same influence on Spinoza. Now let's skip down. I'm not going to go through his method of healing the understanding and his rationalistic view. I want to go over to Roman numeral 4, where he talks about truth and error. And then I want to zero in heavily on Roman numeral 7. Truth and error. Truth is known only through a true idea. The perfect truth is known only through the perfect idea. Error has four causes. Partial nature of our minds provides only fragmentary expression of ideas. Imagination is affected by physical senses and confuses us. Reasoning is often too abstract and general, and failure to begin with the perfect idea. Now, if you begin at the wrong place, what did I say? Methodology determines theology. Where did he begin? He began by denying that your senses are bringing valid information to you. If you begin there, you're in trouble. Because you begin there, where are you going to end? Well, you're not going to end with a literal interpretation of anything, because if you deny the senses, you deny this is a solid table, or you're seeing a real physical human being, you're going to have to end up somewhere in the abstract or mystical realm. You can end up a rationalist or a mystic or both, because you've denied the external world and the senses and the basis for the historical grammatical hermeneutic. Aristotle had a literal hermeneutic. Plato had an allegorical hermeneutic. Aristotle is the whipping boy, the modern Amills, anti-inerrantist, and all the other heretics. Why? Because Aristotle laid down the canons for clear thinking called logic. He laid down the canons for literal hermeneutic. And if you stop thinking logically and stop thinking with the literal